We gotta band together. There's strength in numbers. We're still in our intellectual prime and have plenty to offer.
Is that you or me?
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 369.
Nice.
For the week of August 23rd, 2021. I am naughty desk plate David T. Cole, and I'm here with scathing eval Sarah D. Bunting.
Boring.
Judgmental auntie Tara Ariano.
If only there was a good Korean woman in his life.
And tenured office napping sofa, Robert Krutt.
David Duchovny is a best-selling author.
Look it up. Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us, it's our old friend, Robert Bobby Krutt. Hello, Bobby.
Bobby.
Welcome back. Thank you.
I should say he is a faculty member in the writing department at the University of California, which is germane because we are here to talk about The Chair, not the one that was a Fox game show hosted by John McEnroe, that was a Starz competition show for film directors.
Sniff.
Another one. And here is the premise. Emily Dickinson scholar Ji-Yoon.
Emily Dickinson!
Sandra Oh has just been elected the first female chair of the English department at Pembroke College, a lesser Ivy. She has big plans for her chairwomanship, like shepherding the tenure process for Yaz, Nana Mensa, an up-and-coming American lit star and the department's only other person of color. At the same time, she's being pressured by her dean, Paul, David Morse, to urge the department's three highest-paid and least-enrolled professors to take early retirement, and Bill, J. Duplass, Ji-Yoon's best friend in the department and maybe more, almost immediately touches off a huge campus scandal in one of his lectures. The chair was co-created by Amanda Peet, that one, and Annie Wyman, who is a PhD candidate in English at Harvard, for whom this is her first IMDb credit. All six episodes of the season dropped on Netflix last Friday. We will try to be mindful of spoilers, but may refer to events from any of those episodes. Let us do the Chen check-in. Bobby, should our listeners watch The Chair?
Yes, if, but yes.
Sarah?
Yes.
Dave?
I'll say probably.
I'll say yes, and I'll especially say yes if you liked Mrs. Fletcher, because I don't know if for some reason I had the same kind of, it gave me the same vibes as that show, which I also really liked. Bobby, we invited you to talk about this show due to your expertise as someone who teaches in a college English department and presumably took English in college, and who interacts with a department chair on a fairly regular basis, probably.
Yes.
How well did they do in terms of realism, given your experience?
I think they did a really good job with the realism as far as the way departments work. There were so many little moments in there that I've witnessed firsthand over and over again, and some problematic and some just fun ones. But I thought they did a really good job. That's actually what my if in the qualification was, is I think it was really good if you're interested in this world, because right. They do get it very well.
Yeah.
Very well done.
Particular academic specialties, I think, do tend to attract certain temperaments. Did you feel they cast this well? Like, did Sandra Oh read as a Dickinson scholar for you? Holland Taylor on Chaucer, Bob Balaban on Melville, etc. How did they do there?
Oh, the casting was so good, I thought. And, you know, it's interesting. I have not seen any of Sandra Oh's big things that she's done that people love her from. I've only seen her, I think, host SNL, which is not a fair gauge of somebody's talents at all. And I thought she captures that teaching tone perfectly. And the scenes where she's running the meetings, it's a very specific energy that people have in those meetings, and I thought she was really good. And the supporting cast was so great. I loved the older teachers, and I loved the younger teachers, too. The casting was spot on, I thought.
Yeah. Sarah, there are some elements here that are specific to life at an Ivy, even though it has admittedly been 3 or 4 years since you were an undergrad. How well did you feel the show captured that world?
That was lovely. Thank you. The motto, lux et verbatim, like, okay, it's supposed to be Harvard, we get it. I was also an instructor for one semester at a very different kind of department, but just, like, how you have to handle, like, department grandees, like, that was something that I was confronting, like, 10 days into the job was the department head literally falling asleep in my class while I was screening a Golden Girls episode. Yeah. Hashtag never forget. Mm-hmm. So like a lot of this with like the sort of older hidebound faculty members was familiar. And then just like, why must everyone wear duffel coats at Ivy League institutions? Like, they are unflattering. The pockets are like, the pockets aren't great. Who needs to be toggling? But yeah, like I was sort of wishing at times that there was either a spinoff or just like a whole other series about Holland Taylor's character. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because what a pleasure. Like every time she's on screen, she is just so funny and like she's like in a corner reading and getting wasted at a party. I was like, my people. But yeah, I thought this was, there were parts of it that were impatience making. And I feel like at times it did not trust the central premise. And so it loads in some stuff about the kid. And then there immediately has to be this like tension with the, you know, decompensating widower novelist rock star teacher who, you know, you gave your pie to a Nazi, but they keep it moving, which is key. Yeah. So as much as I felt like it was, I don't know, not responding to network notes exactly, but just like maybe this focus is not necessary for this. The pacing made up for that. So
yeah.
I haven't watched the whole thing yet, but I plan to because it just sort of, I think it's getting more sure-footed about what it's trying to do. So
yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong about that.
If I can add to that, that's an interesting point, Sarah, because I had watched the first three episodes and I thought, okay, well, I'm done. That's enough to watch. But then this morning I woke up really early and then I watched the other half and it was such a, I liked the first half, but the second half seemed, it stuck the landing more than I expected it to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not surprised to hear that.
Yeah.
So since you mentioned the decompensating rock star novelist widower, once we get to the blowback from Bill's big scandal, the story has to contend with that, which I was sort of bracing for because lots of different shows have tried to make stories about cancel culture, barf. But I thought this was actually a compelling take, given that, A, it is set in a place where discussions about free speech and challenging ideas are not just relevant but essential, and, B, no one says cancel. Like, that's not a term that really gets used that I can recall. So what did the rest of you think about the handling of Bill's plot? Let's start with Bobby, since he's probably been present for campus dust-ups of not exactly this sort, but, you know, things where students all get mad.
But similar, yeah, sure. Oh, absolutely. You know, yeah, I thought that it handled that well. And I also want to say, I agree. The fact that the word cancel never comes up, that has become to me like automatic poison for a show. Like it's it's so tired already. So I love that it never came up in such an obvious way. And I think that I thought it was handled well. And again, I don't want to spoil anything, but I like where it winds up landing in terms of the resolution to that story.
I agree. Dave, what did you think?
I enjoyed this ride only because it's like one of those little piece of some world that I'm not really familiar with, and you get to see how it works, how all the gears are turning. That part of it was very interesting. The weak link for this show for me was the rock star professor. I didn't buy that he was a get. I know he's not supposed to be like a rock star to everybody, but I didn't quite buy that Sandra Oh's character would really kind of want him around otherwise. Like, he seemed like a real drip and a loser, and I didn't really see the appeal there. Like, so I actually really enjoyed the academic part of it. It was all the other stuff that I was sort of like going back to what Sarah was saying, like, it did move fast enough that by the time you're starting to get annoyed by him outside the school or Sandra Oh's kid or whatever, it's sort of zapped back to Bob Balaban et al. Grousing or David Morse trying to figure out what the hell he's going to do. David Duchovny's there also later on in the series. Why? I'll let you watch. But
history's greatest writing robot. Come on.
So I was interested in what I think when Sarah was saying about the network notes is maybe they were hedging their bets with all this other stuff, where the core idea of the series started as what happens in these sort of small ecosystems at a university. Why is everything so right. political all yeah. the time? As a series, I would be fine with just that. Now, it's doing more, and I think it's doing more because it wants to broaden its appeal, and I get that. I'm just saying all the appeal broadening elements were the weakest ones for me.
Hmm.
That said, Amanda's Pete's best work since Max Headroom.
Not true, but I'm glad that you brought her up because she did not get enough credit in the stupidly named Dirty John season two, neither Dirty nor John. I have always thought that she was super underrated.
Me too.
I've been saying this for like 15 years. And it, like, universe, put some respect on the Pete because she's great.
Yeah, togetherness apparently lost the thread, but she was spectacular in it. She's she's such a good actor. Also one of the people that I saw at the gym in LA when we lived there who looked, unlike a lot of celebrities I saw there, and there were many, she looked extremely miserable to be working out. And I was like, I support you because it is. It sucks to work out. You're right.
You've told that story before. I always forget that she was just, she's like, fucking dude.
She did.
Like,
she's
that
just
makes
like,
me like her even more. Like, exactly. Yeah, this is terrible.
Yeah. On the Bill fantastic. Tip, though, I don't agree with Dave. I thought they did a good job, like, establishing his relationship with Juju, who's Sandra Oh's character's daughter. And I think it's crucial because otherwise, it's true that there's like, what could a Sandra Oh character possibly
hire a
babysitter. See in this crumpled man, as he is called?
This crumpled man. I love the grandpa.
I kind of wanted the kid to be played by the little shit from Benedict Society, though, because they have similar vibes. You know,
Constance.
They're kind of a pill, yes. and they're sarcastic, and they have no filter.
Yeah.
But I felt like, boy, like that was an 11 at Benedict Society, and this is, you know, she's at a 7 or something here.
Yeah,
I just really wanted that amped up.
All right, we already touched on Holland Taylor as Joan. The three profs who are on the list, capital T, capital L, too much or not enough of them? Bobby, what did you think?
I could have stood to have just a little bit more of them, actually. I thought Holland Taylor had a great arc, and she had so much. Bob Balaban, like the scene with him, this isn't really spoiling anything, but him and his wife later in the season was so good, I thought. And one of the things the show does really well, I think, is it doesn't demonize anybody. Everybody's a little bit problematic and everybody's a little bit good. And I like that. Like, it has some empathy for these older teachers. And I actually wanted to see a little bit more of that. I'm kind of with Dave, where I feel like some of the backstory, the family side of things could be trimmed down and we could have more with those teachers. I would have been happy with that.
Yeah,
I agree. I thought Balaban's character in particular, like he has a number of punchable moments where like they've been lumped together co-teaching and this, you know, rock star teacher, black woman who actually like over enrolls her section is just like, he's just in that mode where he's like, I'm right. And why get into it?
Yeah.
And it isn't personal, but that's the problem. And then her responses in those scenes, like when she's just reacting by trying not to react. And shout out to Lila, Bill's TA, who is just like in full panic mode all the time. And her like flinchy sort of filling her shorts reactions all the time.
Yeah.
So like, so relatable. But yeah. Balaban, I think, was perfectly cast for this. I think maybe my problem with Bill is that this casting is not quite right for me. The character as conceived is kind of, you know, crumpled, but I think maybe that casting isn't quite it, but everybody else is just flawless and sort of unafraid to look like short-sighted buttholes sometimes. And Balaban in particular, like, what a perfect portrayal of this, you know, old man who's not going to be questioned. Mm-hmm. So
it seems like his whole career has been leading up to playing a part just like this,
Where
he's an old professor. That was actually one of my only, in the early episodes, there were so many little aspects of the meetings and the life that were so perfect, but then there were a couple choices that I just thought they would never do that Sandra Oh's character asked the young teacher to co-teach with this old teacher. I understand the the idea behind it, but co-teaching never goes well, especially with some, even people who like each other wind up getting irritated with each other. So if she was really trying to help her friend go through tenure, I don't think that she would have ever done that. But that was my own experience with co-teaching, maybe. But I certainly, I didn't buy that choice, even though I like what it's set up.
I just want to say prayers up for Dave, who had to listen to me every time Joan was rhapsodizing about Chaucer, me going, wrong! Still traumatized by my Middle English and Old English classes as an undergrad. So
no doubt that was a chore to learn, but I will once again put a plug in for the History of English podcast, which is really great, and actually the Chaucer part of it, even though I'm sure it was a pill to learn.
Yeah.
And it all kind of Greek to me when I hear it. And actually hearing that part of the history of English was very interesting. So learn about it, but don't practice, I guess.
We've already mentioned him, so I just should say, if you're flagging in the run of the show, and there are only 6 half-hour episodes, which, by the way, like, let's support the half-hour dramedies so we get more, because, yes, hello, we love them. But David Duchovny is so funny. And He's really good. It's worth sticking around. I believe his episode is episode 5. And that's like you're 5/6 of the way through it by the time you get to him. So yeah, this was like my first thing that we've watched for a lead topic that I've really liked in a long time. So I'm glad we got to get to it. And I'm glad everybody else liked it too.
Yeah, same.
And I want to just say thank you because you asked me to take part. And watching it, I realized, oh, it's this beautiful northeastern snowy campus. And I teach literally at a big state university that is on the beach. So it was like the exact polar opposite. And yet I still felt very connected. So thank you.
Oh.
Why, it is time to go around the dial. Our first stop, as always, is with Tara.
Yep, highbrow, lowbrow here. Let's start with the highbrow. 9 Perfect Strangers, a new show on Hulu, in which a new group of guests who are the titular strangers, they're arriving for a 10-day retreat at a wellness place called Tranquillum, run by a mysterious Russian woman named Masha. Supposedly it's in California, but it famously shot in Australia during lockdown last summer when shit there was less bad. It's more bad now. But basically every person in it that you don't know is Australian, but also so are Nicole Kidman and Samara Weaving. So upon arrival, I just want to note, everyone has to give up their phones. Already, this is a terrible idea. There are only 3 kinds of people who take your phone away from you: cops, terrorists, and your mom. So it's not the energy I want on vacation, personally. I won't get into all the characters because we don't learn everyone's deal in the first episode, which, spoiler, is the only one I did or will watch. But the notable ones who get showcased in the premiere are the Marconis, a family, Michael Shannon, an Australian lady I don't know, playing his American wife and their daughter, who is 20. They've apparently just lost a child. Frances Welty, played by Melissa McCarthy, is a big deal famous author who finds out on the drive to Tranquillum that her latest book has been rejected. Sidebar, Frances Welty and Napoleon Marconi, which is Michael Shannon's guy's name, are such person in a book name, barf, based on a novel.
Kind of like Harry.
Exactly. Ugh. Anyway.
Yeah.
Jessica and Ben, that's Samara Weaving and Melvin Gregg from season 2 of American Vandal. He was the main basketball star guy. Here, she's an influencer of some kind. He is also rich. We don't know how, but he drives a Lamborghini. Weaving is extremely good finding the truth in her influencer character, but that does not mean Jessica is someone that I want to spend literally any time with. And then we also have Bobby Cannavale as Tony, Regina Hall as Carmel, and Luke Evans as Lars. And Tiffany Boone, who played the Kerry Washington character in flashbacks in Little Fires Everywhere, and Manny Jacinto from The Good Place are also in it. They play staffers at the resort. As soon as I said there was a mysterious Russian woman named Masha, you already knew that was going to be Nicole Kidman kind of doing an accent and definitely wearing a wig. Of course, both things are true. She also has a scar on her chest, which she, like, showcases in low-cut top. So we find out why by the end of the first episode. And also, the guests were specifically selected by her to be there at the same time with each other. She curates the mix, we are told. And her story is that she died temporarily after getting shot in the chest. Manny's character was the EMT who helped revive her. And she tells the guests they have all come here to die and she will bring them back. So all of the articles about the show obviously compare it to The White Lotus, which had also just ended like 2 days before this one premiered. If you only have time to watch one, White Lotus. This one is based on a novel, of course, given those stupid character names, by Leanne Moriarty, created by David E. Kelley. The last time the three of them got together, we got Big Little Lies, which had a spectacular first season, then a totally unnecessary second season. This one seems never to have found a thread at all, not lost it like Big Little Lies did. But none of it rang true to me. Honestly, from the very first shot of a smoothie being made from the inside of the blender, I was like, this is a baloney. I can't really put my finger on why that tipped me, but I was right. I will say, Melissa McCarthy is very good. It's fun to see her playing a character who, although she's like unhappy and messy, she's also really glam. She has great glasses, great lipstick. Look up pictures of her, move on. But at the end of one episode, I didn't care to know any more about any of these characters. I also just know there's going to be some kind of mystery. I do not care to find out what it is. Oh, my lowbrow pick. Guys, messiness. So as we all know, MTV has transitioned to a 98% Dear Deck programming model. Last year, Ridiculousness spun off Deliciousness, which I talked about on this podcast. That was all about food videos hosted by Tiffany Thiessen. Since that time, they've also added Adorableness with Allison Hannigan. And as of this week, the latest brand extension is Messiness with, for no reason, a Y. Deliciousness was not good, so I never would have even checked this one out if not for the fact that one of the people on it is Tori Spelling. There's also Adam Rippon from Figure Skating and Teddy Ray, who I think is a comedian. But here's the thing. Tori's not even the host. The host is Snooki, who... sure, she's messy, but she's definitely less famous than Tori. Like, if I was Tori's agent, I would tell her not to do this unless she gets to be the messy Whoopi Goldberg, but I'm not, and maybe that's the problem.
Well, and Snooki quit Jersey Shore Family Reunion, like, 2 years ago because it was too messy and taking away from family time, quote, unquote. So, what? Right.
And she's fine as a pop culture personality, in my opinion, but she is not a host, and the teleprompter is not serving her at all. Like, there's no reason for her to close out each segment by stating, and that's it for The Fuck Stops Here, which is the first segment. Instead of just moving on and opening the next one, when each chunk has its own video treatment, I lasted to the first commercial, and that was plenty. But here, since I'm here, I'll also say, Ridiculousness is bad. I don't understand how this has become, like, the empire on MTV. I watched the last couple of minutes of the season 20 premiere, waiting for the start of Messiness. Dear Deck is also extremely awkward on camera for someone who's been doing this for 20 seasons. And his panelists are terrible, not funny. Like, never mind music videos. MTV owns so many good, fun shows like Made and The Real World and Jackass. Like, if you're not going to air videos, air those. You can't find the Jackass TV show anywhere unless you really, really look. Wink. But anyway, to reiterate, Messiness is bad. Don't watch it. And that's the end of Tara's Around the Dial. That's my Snooki homage. For my plug... the National Network of Abortion Funds is running a campaign right now to fight an extremely draconian anti-abortion law here in the state of Texas. And so you should donate to them if you can, because it's very important work that they do, not only in Texas, but all around the country. So we'll link this in the show notes, too. But go to nnaf.org/donate-TX-abortion-funds to help with this particular campaign.
I got a couple more names for you for that thing.
Okay.
Attila O'Connor.
Yep.
Imhotep Smith.
Great.
Bobby, your turn. What do you got?
Okay, I was all set to talk about a highbrow and a lowbrow, and then last week, both of the shows that I picked were on last episode, and that was White Lotus, which I really enjoyed. I mean, I know some people were conflicted about the ending, but regardless of that, I was totally immersed in that show from beginning to end. And then my lowbrow was going to be to talk about In Public, Big Brother, because one of the first times, Tara, I'm sure you don't remember this, but one of the first times we met in person, I admitted to you that I watched Big Brother, and you just looked at me and said, oh, Bobby.
Yeah.
It's not something I'm proud of, but now I'm putting it on the record. And
I have such a...
I know. That was the same night that Dave chastised me for saying I like Treme. So it was a great night all around for our friendship. So
I believe I probably said something on the lines of that show is homework.
You said you like shows that are textbooks. That's what you said to me. It was great. And we're still friends, and it's great.
I'm a dick.
So I laughed. It was very, very funny. So I that was the same night too, now that I think about it. But I don't want to get into reminiscing too much, and I want to say
Sarah,
that.
How did you make Bobby's first night uncomfortable?
That's true.
I think I pelted him with golden raisins.
I remember. That's right.
I do. How could I forget?
Which sounds like it could be a scene from the show that I am going to talk about, which is I Think You Should Leave season two. There's the segue. And that is, I thought that you all had talked about it, but I don't think you've talked about the second season. And I'm so happy because the first season, I don't know that I've laughed that hard in years at a TV show. And I thought the first season was pitch perfect. And I was nervous going into the second season. And right from that first sketch where this is, I Think You Should Leave with Tim Robinson. I didn't say the whole name. When he's trying to eat the hot dog from his sleeve, I knew it was good. I knew it was going to be as good as the first season. I know a lot of people have been, and I can't really summarize a sketch show, I guess, but I know a lot of people have been reposting the prank show sketch where he's in this ridiculous outfit and the Dan Flashes shirts. But my favorite sketches, I think, are the tables one at the end where Patty Harrison is really the pun. It's incredible. It's that we've watched it about 100 times. And then I also liked a lot that there was kind of a melancholy in a lot of the sketches, which differentiates it from the first season where some just end on a real down note, which is different. And it works. Like the Bob Odenkirk sketch is really funny, I think. Yeah, I mean, it's such a bittersweet sketch. And it's hilarious, but it's melancholy. And then the sketch with the guy who is cursing all the time at the haunted house, how it ends. Yeah, it's such a perfect ending. And that sketch, if you have it, just a guy who goes to a haunted house, and it's the adult tour, so you're allowed to say bad words. And I had taken a friend of mine from high school years ago to an improv show, and he was a very 9-to-5 kind of guy, and they said, we want suggestions, and he proceeded to yell out the most obscene, horrible things to my girlfriend and my friends at the same time. And it was like he got the cut loose. So that sketch rang very, very true to me. But it's just a great show. Not every sketch lands, you know, but it's fantastic. And I'm a sucker too. This has nothing to do with the quality of the show, but I love when there's people who were on SNL for a relatively brief period. I know he wrote for SNL for a while before he was on, and SNL wasn't the right fit. And then you go somewhere else and it's like, no, you were meant to do this other thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You weren't meant to be in the Rolling Stones. You're meant to be Elvis Costello or something like that. You're meant to be somewhere out of the mainstream. And that's kind of what this was. So yeah, I love it. I think it's a great show, and I encourage people to watch the second season who have not. For my plugs, I have a couple of books that I've written that are on my website that can take you to the publishers and Amazon and all that stuff. And I have a new book coming out in the fall in October called Watch Me Trick Ghosts. It's poems, and that will be available for pre-order soon. But for my other plug, I want to do a household plug because my significant other is a big fan of this show, and she is on a Netflix show called The Kominsky Method, which just got nominated for an Emmy for the second time, and we are not able to go to the ceremony, obviously. So this will be like the celebration, getting to mention the show on here. It's a great, speaking of half-hour dramedies, it's a half-hour show, and it's Michael Douglas and Alan Arkin, and Sarah Baker is my significant other, soulmate.
I was going to prompt you for that, but yes, very good.
She's been here.
Your significant other is Alan Arkin? Jesus, nobody tells me anything.
He's very tender. Sarah's Michael's daughter on the show. And in a wonderful twist to our episode this week, at my school, the endowed dean of my college is the Michael Douglas Endowed Chair of Humanities.
Hey,
so it's a great little way things turn around. So anyway, check out her show. It's great. And thank you very much.
We'll link it in the show notes.
Sarah Baddeck.
I am here to talk about Unforgotten, which is one of those British shows that makes you think that just like England is too dangerous to live in because there's just so many murders. And also that like their cold case units, which are called historic murders there, which I think is a much better name. Just like are always working on something like guys.
It's a lot of pressure though to be called a historic murder.
That's true.
Yeah. And it's an historic murder because England. So it's like, oh, an historic murder. Well,
we all miss Gladys, but really historic? I mean,
it's an iconic murder.
Okay.
That's what they call it in Scotland. Just kidding. So the season finale aired for us here in the States on Masterpiece last week, as you're listening to this. So the whole season should be on demand on your local PBS station and on the app. And this aired long enough ago in the UK as well that anyone who cares about spoilers has probably had them trickle through thanks to casting news anyway. But long pause, spoilers ahoy, fun aho. Okay, I'm not entirely sure how I feel about the decision to kill off Cass Stewart in the series 4 finale. On the plus side, I do think the character had run its course because, as with a lot of characters that this actor, Nicola Walker, tends to play, Helen Bartlett on Scott and Bailey for one, Stevie on River for another, Cass was both relatable and off-putting in the Jane Tennant mold. And after a while, you just are tired. With that, I think the show will be fine without her. There's a lot of talent amongst the secondary leads, and I hope Sanjeev Bhaskar gets more to do as Sonny Khan when the show comes back in 2022, which apparently it is doing. On the other hand, one of the Series 4 storylines had to do with Cass sticking in for this last case to get her pension. Yes, that's right. You who have seen TV before probably know how that's going to go. She was, in fact, getting too old for that shit. So against her own better judgment, she didn't just bail. She stuck it out for one more case. And between a pre-existing out for this character and the fact that the fatal exit ramp, literally, that they went with instead seemed mostly like an excuse for a lot of capital A acting and maudlin callbacks to previous conversations and voiceover, I did not love it. It was like emotionally lazy, in my opinion. Anyway, I know a couple of you also watched, so you can let me know what you thought. And also, if I should keep an eye out for Walker's next gig, the recently premiered Annika, which current reviews in the UK press are not big fans of her accent. And also, this is supposed to be a dramedy about a Norwegian cold case detective and a question mark. I don't know. Maybe it'll make its way to PBS and I, lulled by the sight of her, will watch it anyway. Yes, Dave.
Well, I had a question about when you were saying like she had an out. Do you mean like it was written in case she didn't want to come back and then she decided she wanted to come back? So there's this weird sort of teeter-totter thing happening with the script?
Yeah, like there was kind of no reason to kill her because the character could have kind of gone either way, depending on what Walker decided to do. But then I guess she was like, fuck you. So they're like, no, fuck you. And she just lay there with a tube in her mouth for the whole episode at the end.
Talking about a historic ending. So in CSI, we've been watching, I think we're in season 5.
We are almost done season 5.
Okay.
You know, one of the blonde Fox News lab people, and I don't even know her character's name, but she's not the very first one who does the face reconstruction. I think she comes in season 4 when they split the shifts. Anyways, she obviously was going to be probably leaving because she has this whole thing with Gil Grissom. This one's like, you know, I just need to go out on my own. And, you know, this isn't what I signed up for. And Gil Grissom was like, well, I'm going to miss you. And then like 2 episodes later, it's like, hey, I thought maybe I'd just come back. Why? It was just like so poorly executed. Just what you said reminded me of that.
That I think about it, this is what some of these British murder shows need is more rock screams from The Who. For my plug. Speaking of crimey things, I have made up a rubric to tell just how true crimey an actor or director's career is.
I can't believe it took you so long to figure this out, by the way.
I cannot either. Finding an initialism that would spell out something stupid took a while. I did it, though.
You did.
It's the best evidence true crime resume percentage, a.k.a. that's right, the bet crap.
Yep.
You got to say it just like that, P.S. And you can dig its premiere over at my True Crime Review newsletter, Best Evidence. I write it with Eve Beatty. That's at bestevidence.fyi. The inaugural bet crap has a fame tracker tie-in because the first real subject is one Carl Malden. Mm-hmm. Just one Carl Malden, but I did learn in my research that he is yet another actor with the same birthday as me. Why is the world lousy with these people? That's my plug.
Love it.
All right, here is what's coming up on the Extra Hot Great Universe. On the next Extra, Extra Hot Great, it is changing lenses, and we discuss when shows change point of views, how that would work. And then we have Gang of Thieves as the next extra, extra hot great. We're putting together a TV team to do a job. Who's going to do it? What are they going to do? What's going to happen? And then on extra, extra hot great, this is going to be 140. It is important TV impersonations talking about actors on TV playing real people to varying degrees of success. All of those which are coming up in the next couple of weeks are available to all supporters at any level. Please go to patreon.com/extrahotgreat to sign up and support this podcast. And then right here on the next EHG Prime, we need to take a week off next week. So we're going to collect a few older extra, extra hot greats into one big delicious ball. And that will include the relatively recent Superfund episode, Shut Up! Which is all about things that need to shut up on TV.
Yep.
And then the week after that, we are back live in the studio. We're going to have Dan Rogge back to talk about American Crime Story impeachment. And he ought to know, he's done impeachment stuff.
He has. Today's extra credit topic comes to us from Doug. It is titled Russian Roulette. And I will just read the description from Doug. Quote, the 2002 game show Russian Roulette knew how to dispose of contestants. Whenever they answered a question wrong, the floor would drop out from under them, immediately sending them falling into oblivion. Choose one TV moment and have a character Russian Roulette-ed dropping away on the spot. Who is it? Where do they fall? And what are the repercussions of their sudden departure? there's a reference video, which I'll include in the show notes. I will go first. Oh, boy. I've talked about the season 3 high-maintenance episode Finger Butt before. This is the one where the great Ken Lung plays Gene, a Brooklyn veterinarian. His job is kind of a bummer for all the reasons we would expect of a vet, but he doesn't want to treat his depression with antidepressants and instead decides to start microdosing mushrooms, I think? Anyway, he does too much, he builds up a tolerance, and ends up just being too high at work, including when a girl and her mother bring in a tuba that their kitten has gotten stuck in, and I won't say what happens next, because I did say it when I talked about it right after it aired, but it's bad and upsetting, and it's entirely Gene's fault. This is the only episode of High Maintenance I would ever consider submitting for the NONAC, but I would never do it, because I don't ever want to watch it again, nor would I subject anyone else to it. It's that bad. It's really horrible and off tone with the vibe of High Maintenance. So with that in mind, I would drop Gene into the void. And in this case, it's the Gowanus Canal. That's the appropriate punishment.
Good luck, Gene.
I would do it right before the tuba makes its appearance. Short term, this will just end his segment on the show before we see a resolution of his story and the consequences of his actions, which, fine, we can use our imaginations. And most episodes cover more than one of the guy's clients, so it would just move on to another one or end. Long term, Gene appeared in two other episodes in the next season, doing much better, no longer microdosing, which is how his story does end in Finger Butt. The tuba incident is a wake-up call that causes him to go on antidepressants after all. But when I see him again, even though he's competently helping the guy with his new pet, a stray dog he's met on the streets of New York, I remember that first episode, and I hate Gene. So his sweetness with this poor little one-eyed dog is tainted by my memory of the tuba. And if Gene were Russian roulette-ed in his first episode, that wouldn't happen. The guy would just go to a different vet who knows how to keep their shit together around other people's beloved pets. Bobby.
Okay. That's one to follow. Like the teacher I am, I have taken this extra credit assignment very seriously and have considered carefully who to give the drop. As our first discussion today was focused on academia, my mind turned to the portrayal of teachers on television. I've decided to earn my extra credit by both keeping it in the educational realm and sucking up to Tara and Sarah by focusing on a show close to their hearts or at least their professional lives. In the 80s and 90s, there was a particular breed of English teacher in pop culture. The floppy-haired, manicured stubble, blazer-wearing cool guy. It was always a guy that could really, you know, relate to the students and inspire them. The character I plan on rouletting made his first appearance in an episode poetically titled A Song of Myself, which is bad enough to make even me, a teacher who teaches a course on Walt Whitman, gag a little bit. These kind of eye-rolling teachers were a sort of template of the time. time. And when I went to school to become an English teacher, these are the folks that my friends and family would say, oh, like that guy.
Oh, no. So
that being said, my Russian roulette drop is reserved for none other than the English teacher and newspaper advisor of West Beverly High on Beverly Hills 90210. That was the reaction I was hoping for.
Suck it, Lopez!
Gil! There's not one particular moment. I'm so happy you responded like that. There's not one particular moment where he is rapping with Brandon or mansplaining something to Andrea while thinking he's motivating her that I'm choosing to drop him. Instead, what I would like to do is, as he walks through the halls of the high school toward their classroom on the very first day, the ground drops out, he plummets through the floor, through the earth, and into the little used LA Metro, which promptly drops him off at the Supercuts in front of the Beverly Center. There, he can begin a lengthy career helping other men like him trim their beards to the perfect stubble length.
Oh, God.
Meanwhile, back at West Beverly, a substitute English teacher, a rumpled old former journalist played by a grizzled Lawrence Tierney or Ed Asner or somewhere similar, shows up and quickly takes over the West Beverly Blaze. Anytime Andrea asks for inspiration, he tells her to beat it, which, while miserable, forces her to take ownership over her accomplishments and not see them through the lens of Brandon and Gil. As for Brandon, every time he starts to get on an annoying soapbox, the new, always aggravated teacher just tells him to shut up, sparing viewers years of Brandon's insufferable behavior, who no longer thinks the sun rises and sets according to his chunky watches. Removing Gil and safely placing him in another noble profession will spare us a generation of cool teachers that we realize were the worst when we get a little older. I never anticipated talking about 90210 in a public forum, but it is very cathartic to perform this educational exorcism via Russian roulette.
Oh, God.
Yes!
That was the best. I wasn't sure if you were going to go with Gil or Mr. Racine. Either would have been fine, but this was so satisfying, especially the Supercuts.
Gorgeous.
So I do want to point out, though, while he's done with the Supercuts, and it does seem like a worthy punishment, he can go across the street in circa 90s and go eat at the soup plantation. So it's not all bad.
That is true. That's the saving grace for Gil.
That's what keeps him from just going completely bonkers.
Sarah. I don't feel that I should have to follow this, but I did actually get into detail and like Googled terms for things for this, so I'm just going to go ahead. The scene I have in mind probably doesn't need a trapdoor because, okay, classic is not the right word for this, but let's go with all-timer, historic, Dave. It's on the strength of this scene alone that the otherwise poorly aged Law & Order episode Ain't No Love got into the canon in episode 316 after all, so I don't know that the universe wants this, but if Serena Sutherland's valedictory, is this because I'm a lesbian scene, could be improved, it would be by D.A. Arthur Branch instead of reacting with bafflement and the scene kind of weirdly trailing off the way it did in real life. The late Fred Thompson rolled his eyes, whipped a cloche off a giant red button on his desk that the viewer can see is marked credits cast ejector, and takes a big old theatrical backswing before mashing it. Kabang goes the trapdoor, but it's not Sutherland we cut to whizzing down an HVAC chute before pinwheeling out of a Center Street Sally Port and into a dumpster next to McCoy's favorite hot dog cart. Oh no! It's Branch. He ejected himself rather than continue this extremely awkward conversation. He's a little dusty and can be heard grumbling about tax dollars at work, but that's how you know he's fine. Cut back to Sutherland having absolutely no goddamn reaction to her boss ending her exit interview by throwing himself in the garbage because it's Liz Romanoff said. Dave!
Never a big fan of I Love Lucy. I was one who rejected it for the canon, but I do have one that works with I Love Lucy. We all remember the classic scene where they're in the candy factory. Her and Ethel are trying to keep up with the conveyor belt to package little bonbons, and they can't. So they start, resort to throwing them off the conveyor belt and start eating them. Yes, very tiresome. So here's what happens. Lucy's friend, Ethel, gets Russian roulette-ed during this. She just falls out, just happens. Now, I think according to the letter of the law here, I'm supposed to follow Ethel's journey after being Russian roulette, but I'm going to deal with the fallout of her getting Russian roulette, which is Lucy is there, and she has to do everything by herself. So she starts eating chocolate after chocolate after chocolate. She gains 40 pounds in one day. And because this is the 50s, she goes home and Ricky leaves her because she's now fat. Mm-hmm. And that all leads to the character of Lucy becoming the character that Lucille Ball plays in the 1985 TV movie Stone Pillow, where Lucille Ball plays a homeless bag lady, I believe was the term they used on the adverts.
Opposite Daphne Zuniga, and spoiler, it's going to be in my next round of again with this
pick.
Patreon.com/againwiththis to hear our discussion of that sometime next month.
Tonight on the CBS Tuesday Night Movies, a world premiere.
Bag lady, why don't you pick another corner?
Because this is my corner, that's why.
Lucille Ball stars in her first network television drama.
Who were you, Flora?
Who'd even remember me?
She had it all and lost everything except her dignity.
I'm still here, and I know how to protect myself.
She's a woman who exists on scraps.
Half a good roast beef sandwich.
And spunk.
With horseradish.
And yesterday's dream. Stone Pillow, next.
Half a roast beef sandwich with spunk and horseradish.
And there's like Love Boat music in the background. Oh, God. I can't wait.
I don't understand that music.
It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Presenting this week is Sarah D. Bunting.
Norm! Today, I am thankful for Season 5, Episode 9 of Cheers, Thanksgiving Orphans. Why is a holiday episode of a sitcom, both forms I'm known to have little patience for, worthy of inclusion in the Extra Hot Great Canon? Reason number one. Cheers understands the pitfalls of a Thanksgiving episode and dodges most of them nimbly. The, quote, plot here is pretty thin. Some of the Cheers gang plans to assemble for a Friendsgiving at Carla's house. Others turn up there when their previous plans have fallen through. And most of it is just moving chess pieces around to set up the usual character-based jokes and especially, spoiler, the climactic food fight. But few sitcoms can avoid the temptation to get capital E earnest in a Thanksgiving episode. Cheers keeps things dampness-free, and even a toast to the departed coach is quick and sweet. The show doesn't get too bogged down in single entendres about stuffing, debates about breast side up versus down, or any of that. It knows exactly what it can expect to get out of the Turkey Day premise, and that's what it gets. A runner, which of course I can't capture in this famously visual medium of podcasting, involving various characters turning the TV away from Frasier like he's not even there, the disoriented grouchiness that sets in after drinking all day and eating dinner weirdly in the afternoon, so well portrayed by the entire cast. But Cheers makes character beats drive the holiday story and not the other way around, is the point, which is why it's actually still funny and not cynical feel-good glop. That brings me, sort of, to reason number two, how good the show was, both with Woody and Coach, at writing so-called dim characters fondly, A, and B, not so broadly that the audience won't believe they can function on their own in the world. Here's Woody letting the air out of Diane's pretension balloon once again when she describes her big Thanksgiving plans at a prof's house. Clip one.
He only invites two or three favored students to break bread with his family and other honored guests such as William Styron. And guess who's going to be there?
William Styron?
Yes, Woody.
Heck, anybody could have got it if they'd really been listening.
That clip ties into reason number three, the number of vintage Cheers, setup punchline, even though you see the payoff coming from some distance, it's so professionally executed, the predictability makes it more enjoyable and not less, sequences. In the next clip, almost everyone in the main cast has already made their way to Carla's living room, with one exception, clip two.
You know, Woody, you're right. Family is not necessarily limited to blood relations.
That's right. It's much better than hanging around with a bunch of dingbat cousins all day long that you don't get to see but once a year.
Yeah, waiting for some dirty old aunt to show up and spoil all your fun.
Gobble, gobble.
You know it's going to be Diane at the door. You know Carla's going to slam the door in her face for the act out. But everyone involved is so matter-of-fact and pro on getting it done, not standing back from their lines or doing too much indicating. It's just pleasurable from a craft standpoint. Reason number four. Even obvious writer's room stalking horses manage, thanks to expert timing and delivery, to get at some real truths. Small truths, but real nonetheless. The first is Fraser's crackpotty rant about the aftermath of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer's supposed triumph. Clip 3.
I'm serious. No, first the other reindeer tease and then ostracize him, and then when his abnormality proves of service, they use him. But then, do they allow him to play in their stupid reindeer games?
Yes.
Oh, no. I know how the song goes. In fact, not only do Donner, Blitzen, et al. Not love him and laugh out with glee, but they doubly despise the bulbous-nosed little whip. Well, I gotta be off. Happy holidays.
First of all, as someone who works in true crime, I've heard some crazy conspiracy theories, but that one's amazing. Second, as a fellow unpopular kid emerita, I always shared Fraser's suspicions that after the events of the song, not everyone in the stable was entirely content with the new pecking order. But I'm not sure I realized I felt that way until Dr. Crane's cold open stem winder on the subject. Later on, there is a pair of bits illustrating a different truth. I've only clipped one, clip 4.
Well, I had planned on just a bit more cooking time, Woods, but traffic on I-93 was bumper to bumper.
I-93? I took the side streets. I got here in 35 minutes, buddy.
Well, you didn't take Mass Avenue all the way.
I took Common.
That's what I got.
It's got potholes in it. Ruins your shotgun.
I need the quickest way to get to the kitchen right now.
Oh, yeah.
I dated a dude in Boston for a couple years, and this could have been a transcript of at least 24 different parties I attended, but municipality aside, there is nothing grown straight men enjoy more than comparing traffic hacks. Nothing. I'm gonna come over and give you a blowjob. Not if you take the Cabinet Plaza exit, you ain't. And as dead on as that part of it is, it also points up another of Cheers' gifts, peas and carrots crosstalk. You're usually seeing it at the pool room end of the actual Cheers bar from the various recurrings besides Cliff and Norm who are seated down there, but the production is consistently excellent in making those sorts of scenes seem effortless. And here we are at reason number 5, that food fight and watching the actors have an absolute ball slinging gloppy potatoes and room temp gravy at each other, not to mention the occasional unblocked slip and slide on some floor yams. They know they only have one take, really, and if it did take more than one, you would never know. Whatever rehearsing they did or did not do, however many times they had to get Studio Hazmat in to help them go back to one, you know you're watching a scripted entertainment, but it does feel organic to the characters and the actors. It also expertly braids together multiple callbacks, including one to the legendarily seldom seen Vera, Norm's wife, played by Bernadette Burkett, a.k.a. the real-life Mrs. George Wendt. And then it makes sure a pie meant for Sam covers Vera's entire face when she actually shows up at Carla's. And the Foley design is choice. This episode is not without flaw. Cheers spends a lot of this season not knowing where Sam and Diane's relationship is from episode to episode, or frankly from minute to minute, or how to make that ambiguity credible instead of merely expedient to mine for jokes, most of which, not for nothing, are at Diane's expense and increasingly ungenerous to character and actor at best. Certainly, this pouty objection to how the rest of the gang is passing the time waiting for the big meal isn't going to get the extra hot great group on her side. Clip 5.
You're right. You know, let's turn it back on a football guy's
card. No, enough is enough. I don't think watching television was the Pilgrims' original intent when they created the holiday.
First of all, how dare you? Second of all, this is totally on brand. But also, for some reason, Diane is holding one of Carla's kids' pull-along phone toys for most of this scene. And that's really my final reason that this episode is canon-worthy, that I think we may not, as a culture, have a deep enough appreciation for how powerful a current Shelley Long was swimming against every goddamn minute with the character of Diane Chambers. Sometimes Diane is unbearable. Sometimes she seems downright delusional. Long manages to keep her reasonably well integrated into the milieu and plots, so if you rewatch this episode after hearing my presentation, keep an eye out for that aspect of it and how much more wearying Diane is on paper if you really think about it. Thanksgiving Orphans is all the things Cheers did well, even during its uneven seasons. mostly with purpose, but sometimes in spite of itself. It's funny, well-crafted, it's got airborne peas, and I hope that you will invite it over to watch wrestling in the living room of the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Thank you, Sarah. Bobby, you chose this from our list. Why don't you please start us off?
I did choose it from the list because I had somewhat recently gotten back into watching Cheers on a plane. I watched a bunch of episodes in a row. And remembering how funny it was, I saw this on the list and was like, we have to do this one. And I have such sweet memories of watching this when it was on. I was the age when I was just allowed to start watching Cheers this season. So I remember watching this episode with my whole extended family, and every beat of the show, everybody was cheering and shouting and laughing really loud. And I just, the minute the food fight started, it's like I have such a vivid memory of cracking up at that age and finding it the funniest thing in the world. And I still do. And then I remember, too, the reveal that Vera's going to come, and then you don't see her. And it was just everyone in the room went, no, you know, everybody bought it hook, line, and sinker. You know, now we're also jaded. We expect that sort of thing. But it was such a nice, you know, moment to watch it at the time. And now watching it again, it's not necessarily the funniest Cheers episode, but I love just watching all of them firing on all cylinders. They're so comfortable with each other. Mm-hmm. They're all at the top of their game. And people who I didn't appreciate enough at the time where – Shelley Long's a great example. When I was a kid, it was like, ugh, I don't care for her, you know, because the character was annoying. And now I watch it and you realize how talented she is and how what a great job she does with that. And Frasier, too. Kelsey Grammer, who now I just, you know, I can't not think of how he's kind of crazy and conservative and everything in real life. But yeah, he's so funny on Cheers. So, yeah, they're all at the top of their game. And just one last thing that I love about this one, Sarah, you touched on this, is Cheers was so good at not being corny and sentimental, but just giving us enough of a taste to feel it. Mm-hmm. So that toast for Coach at the end, you know, you get emotional just from that one little moment, mm-hmm. and that's enough. Yeah, you don't need to then have them take out a picture or just that one toast. It was just perfect. So it had that great sense of being emotional without maudlin, and I really appreciate it. So I loved watching it again. I'm not up to that season in my rewatch at this point, but it was a real treat to watch it again. So thank you for putting the presentation together.
Oh, sure. Thanks for picking it.
I'll go next. We rewatched Cheers, I guess, a couple of years ago now. And yeah, it's so good. Every episode is, you know, play-like in the best way. And the thing about, you know, we talk about this with sitcoms especially, that like, you know, you don't want them to go on too long, but there is a certain kind of magic that happens once you're a few seasons in and the cast all, as Bobby said, like really know each other, mm-hmm. and know the beats of an episode and like how the pacing and everything. And what's especially remarkable about this episode is that all of this happens outside of the bar. Like it's one of the few episodes that is not actually set on their set.
So and usually those don't work on this show for me. Like whenever they go to Cape Cod, it's sort of like, oh, here we are in the dining room of this B&B. This is not going to be
right.
good. So extra impressive.
Or something annoying is happening at Rebecca's apartment or whatever. But that's also later. But yeah, this is great. I mean, the Diane is the batty old aunt. It's like, yes, exactly. There's a very similar joke this season on Brooklyn Nine-Nine where Jake says like the squad is his family and like Holt is his dad and Boyle is his brother and Amy is his mom. It's like, yes, Amy is your mom. That's the problem. But like, at least the show is like lampshading it. So yeah, then Diane being the batty aunt is perfect. Also her reference later to how the prof's dinner went awry. And there's a reference to Miss Radziwill's like, I hear you. But yeah, the whole thing building to that food fight is perfect. I have to think they only did it once and that they knew these guys would nail it because they knew they had to, and they do. And especially like, because it's not just, you know, you have to reset everything if they fuck it up. It's like they're in front of a studio audience. Like if there has to be another take, it's not going to work. Yeah. And the audience has to not know it's coming, really, for them to get the reaction that we hear, which is as much as multicam sitcoms are like, you know, not the style anymore. Sometimes something would only work in that setting as well as it does. And this is one, I think. So all of that leading up to the Vera reveal, non-reveal is like, okay, again, I see you. Perfect. Mm-hmm. So it's a great episode. I can't imagine not inducting it. Dave.
No. I really do feel like the second half is much stronger than the first half in this episode, but I think you can hang a Cannon hat on the second half just fine. It's not like the first half is miserable, but certainly they're building towards something special towards the end of the, you know, Carla household Thanksgiving goings-ons. And as far as the food fight goes, like, how can you not have fun having a food fight, whether it is just on your own, your private own household food fight, or in front of an audience? Like, it's sort of unless somebody slips and smacks their head against the table and it dies, there's sort of like no real way to screw that up.
Yep.
Because everybody's going to have fun. Because, like, I don't care if you're like 8 or 88, a food fight, either you've had it and you had a time of your life, or you haven't had it and you're wondering why and in what circumstances could you actually have an organic food fight and make that happen. I'm in that camp. A food fight seems like so much fucking fun, caveat is it's not in your house. And that I kind of want it to happen. Like, you know how there's escape rooms and there's like smash rooms where you just go in to break shit? Like, how come there's not there should be a food fight room too?
I feel like there is. I will research this and make it happen for you. It,
actually, that does feel like an idea whose time
for is Thanksgiving.
Probably.
Thanksgiving is coming. So,
like, you know how a lot of families on Thanksgiving or Christmas will like do whatever and then go see a movie in the late afternoon?
Yeah.
Like, that'll be the new tradition. You do whatever and then you go and have a food fight and then y'all come back and shower and have turkey and the cranberry and stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't have much to add about the actual canon worthiness of the show because I think you hit it all, that like it is an effortless endeavor to make it seem like everybody here knows everybody in a very real asterisk sitcom kind of way that really works within the confines of the Cheers universe. I do want to give a shout out for this episode being in a time before Heisler beer, which is like the now default non-real beer prop that you see on New Girl and like everything now. They had three. I zoomed in. We've got three different fake beers in this episode. We've got Meisterbrew. Yeah. And then we have Kingsborough, which I'm going to think by the packaging was supposed to be like a Löwenbräu kind of thing.
Probably.
And then we have a Weidermann, which is, judging by the can, a Budweiser knockoff. So not one, not two, but three different beers. Everybody brought their own brand. Nice little touch there. And they're all well done, fakey looking props.
That is an excellent point. And I think there was also a fake Narragansett in there too, because I noticed that one, but just didn't clock it. So yeah, well done. It's a show about a bar. You got to do it.
All right. Let us do the official vote. Bobby.
Yes.
Tara.
Yes.
And I'll say yes too. So. That means that Cheers Season 5, Episode 9, Thanksgiving Orphans, you are hereby inducted into the Extra Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
Before we get in the winner loser of the week, I do want to tell you one thing, Sarah, that I change my gamer tag almost every time I start playing for the week. And I think this week is going to be Peas and Carrot Crosstalk will be my name. And with that, Sarah, who's our winner?
I accept that honor. The winner is not going to be my pronunciation of this actor's name, who I think I've never said his name out loud.
Duhamel.
Let's see what happens. Josh Duhamel?
Duhamel.
Duhamel. Yeah. Anyway, however you pronounce it, he is joining Renee Zellweger. I do know how to pronounce that. In the NBC true crime miniseries, The Thing About Pam, a.k.a. Dateline, the miniseries, yes.
Sarah, what is The Thing About Pam?
The Thing About Pam is there was this, I guess, wrongful conviction. This woman, Betsy Faria, was killed, and her husband's like, no, I swear to God, it wasn't me. And then enter Pam Hupp and the setup.
Got it.
I mean, I don't want to give too much away because that podcast, also called The Thing About Pam, hosted by the great Keith Morrison, is really good.
All right.
And you should listen to it and get ready for this live action version.
Link it in the show notes and then people can find it.
And Tara, pray tell, who is our loser of the week?
Well, a couple of weeks ago, we told you about the Jeopardy host search that somewhat suspiciously ended with executive producer Mike Richards choosing himself to host the show in its syndicated format.
What is self-own?
Yeah, I regret to inform you, the duck is racist. He is milkshake ducked in the fastest possible way. Apparently, he used to have a podcast called The Random, D-U-M-B, which is an awful name for a podcast.
Sure is.
You know, after he announced his winning this job, people went back and listened to it and dug out some instances where he made, as he himself put it, terribly embarrassing jokes that were racist, fatphobic, misogynistic. 2 days after he apologized for that, he stepped down from the job, probably not entirely by his own choice. They had, however, already started filming with him, so there will be 5 episodes with him hosting. It will be the printed upside-down stamp episodes of Jeopardy.
Billy Ripken card of Jeopardy.
Exactly. So, yeah, LeVar Burton was ranking on him, subtweeted him on Friday when this was announced, just tweeted, "Happy Friday," which is funny. John Oliver dragged him on Last Weekend, describing him as a smirking golf bag. People dug out his Price is Right audition tape, which was not successful and is apparently also very bad. He is staying on as executive producer of the show, but TBD.
What?
I mean, we're recording this on August 24th, so I'm going to say watch this space. We'll see if he actually can survive all of this, because this all seems real bad.
Yeah, classic tiered disappearance, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Speaking about classic tiered disappearances, do you know what time it is?
Game time?
Time to disappear into game time.
This is the 7th game time of the season. The scores are Sarah with 3, Tara with 3, Value Guess still looking to get a win. Today we are playing More Anime Bullshit from Noemi and Joelle, who earned themselves an extra credit topic. I will read you some potential anime facts, and you tell me if it is true or false, 1 point per answer over 3 rounds of play. We've played this before a few months ago. This is the sequel, More Anime Bullshit. No real, for us, knowledge base to draw from. So it's mostly an exercise in discovery, but we'll see who wins anyways. Mm-hmm. No steel meals because they're true and false. No equalizer challenge zones because we do have a lot of questions. So let's just throw it to Picky to see who will be going first.
We will start with Sarah.
All right, let's go. Sarah, Bobby, Tara, are we ready to play More Anime Bullshit?
Yes.
Yes.
All right, we'll start it off with round one. True or false, is the following a real anime title? Sarah D. Bunting. My Hero Academia. True or false, anime?
I think that's true.
It is true. Yes, that is real.
I've actually heard of that one.
Bobby.
Me too.
Zombies Ate My Neighbor. Real anime or not? True or false?
False.
You are correct. That is a video game made by LucasArts and released in 1993.
Pretty sneaky, sis.
Tara.
Yep.
Boogie Pop Phantom. Boogie Pop Phantom.
Sure.
Yes, Boogie Pop Phantom is an anime about a Japanese town where a series of grisly murders once took place and teens have begun to disappear once again. Sounds like they got a lot of historic murders on their hands.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah D. Bunting. My gym partner's a monkey.
I feel like that is true.
That is false. Really? That is a 2005 Cartoon Network series about a kid accidentally sent to a middle school for animals. Bobby, how to avoid huge ships.
True.
False. That is a book by Master Mariner John W. Trimmer. It is a practical guide on how to avoid large ships. The Amazon reviews are recommended reading.
Oh.
Tara.
Yep.
Humanity has declined.
I'm going to say false.
True.
Oh.
It is an anime about humanity's population declining and a bunch of fairies taking over.
That maybe it was a Quillette article headline.
Mm.
Sarah.
Yes.
Peter Grill and the Philosopher's Time.
Peter Grill and the Philosopher's Time.
Grill like barbecue grill. Right. Kind of thing.
And the Philosopher's Time.
Yeah.
I feel like that's real, but not anime, so I'm going to say false.
It is. It's an anime about the world's strongest fighter and the women who want to bear his genetically superior children.
Sure.
Hmm.
God.
Okay. Bobby. Ladies versus butlers.
True.
It is true. Would it's an anime about students attending an academy that specializes in training maids and butlers for high society placements.
Okay.
Ladies versus butlers. Tara.
Mm-hmm.
Swordfish trombones.
Balls.
Correct. That is a Tom Waits album.
Wow.
Last question for each of you for round one. Sarah D. Bunting. Savage Sword of Jesus Christ.
False.
Correct. That is a comic from Heavy Metal Magazine.
Thought maybe it was a hymn.
Mashup of Conan the Barbarian and, of course,
Savage
our Lord and
Sword
Savior, Jesus
Christ.
Bobby Crutt. With a dog and a cat, every day is fun.
That's the title?
With a dog and a cat, every day is fun.
Factually,
true.
That is false.
Whatever your opinion is of that combination in the real world, that is in fact an anime, a short form anime series about an artist living with her adorable dog and misanthropic cat. So that part checks out anyways.
Mm-hmm.
Last question, round one for Tara.
Yep.
In the Night Garden.
False.
Correct. That is an unsettling British children's show. And that is round one. So Tara, round one scores, please.
Oh, my God. It's so close. Sarah has 2 points. Bobby and I are tied with 3.
All right. Let's get right back to it. Round two, true or false, is this the real name of an anime character?
Okay.
With the caveat that she said I would allowed to pronounce them any way I feel necessary. And
oh boy.
That I shall do. So
it won't make a difference to us, probably.
If you watch shows and you're like, oh, Dave, I know. And I'm embracing it. Theopolis Lovelaces for Sarah D. Bunting.
True.
That is false. That is a character from Tyra Banks' young adult novel Model Land.
Oh, no.
That exists.
Bobby. Tony Chopper. Tony Chopper. Talking Chopper talks with his chopper.
Tony. True.
He is a tiny reindeer from the anime One Piece who ate a mushroom that gave him human traits and intelligence and subsequently became a doctor on a pirate ship.
That works.
As one does.
Shouldn't he be a beaver? Whatever. You don't make the news. Fine.
Tara.
Yeah.
Nunnally Lamperouge.
False.
True, she's the angelic, blind, paralyzed, and frankly pretty dim sister of the protagonist in the anime Something Something, which we'll get into later.
Okay.
Sarah D. Bunting. Bellerophon Tornado Shanks. Bellerophon Tornado Shanks. You are... That is a former football coach and health instructor who serves as a replacement captain on C-Lab 2021.
I assumed it was some Harry Potter bullshit.
This is question 17.
It's pretty good.
It is for Bobby. Anthema device.
False.
Correct. She is a witch with a PhD from the book and show Good Omens.
Yeah.
Tara.
Yep.
Garlic Jr.
True.
He is a little green alien and minor villain in Dragon Ball Z.
He sounds very cute.
Or as we say, Dragon Ball Z. This is question. 19. Lunar Moonface Nikolov.
Moonface Nikolov. Oh. False.
He is a humanoid monster from the anime Buso Renkin, who has a crescent moon for a head and says moon all the time. Sounds like sure. Spoon for okay. The tick, but he says moon. That's the difference there. Bobby, Train Hartnett. Train Hartnett.
True.
Correct. He's a former hitman and the protagonist of the anime Black Cat. And our last question for round two to Tara. Guts.
False.
He is a mercenary and a protagonist of the medieval fantasy anime Berserk.
Oh boy.
Berserk. Do you love making fuck Berserker? That is round two. Scores please, Tara.
Well, they're starting to change. Sarah has 3. I have 4. Bobby pulling away with 6.
All right. Round 3 is our last round. Everybody has, lots of questions left still. This is a big one. Round 3, which of the following plot points actually happens? Well, we do a show. Each of you will get 1 or 2 questions about that show. You tell me whether that plot point is true or false for the show.
Okay.
Code Geass is the show. The concept, a high school student of noble blood combines his innate strategic genius with supernatural abilities granted by a mysterious green-haired girl who loves Pizza Hut in order to lead an insurrection against a tyrannical empire. He is also on the student council. That is the concept. That is true. Sarah Debunting, here's your plot point. You tell me whether it's true or false about Code Geass. The hero's estranged father is a tyrant emperor who secretly seeks to destroy God in order to create equality among all human beings. Pretty fucking lofty goal, if you ask me.
Yeah, that's pretty arrogant, dude. True.
That is true. Bobby, it turns out that God is one of the hero's classmates, and until the hero shows up, she's so bored that she almost destroys the universe.
True.
False. That is a different anime. Different anime than Melancholy of Some Guy. I'm not even going to try to pronounce that one. Tara, here is your plot point.
Okay.
From Code Geass. The hero inadvertently uses mind control to compel an angelic princess to murder a stadium full of refugees using giant robots and a machine gun.
False.
Oh, that's true.
Fuck.
It's just a stadium full of refugees.
I was like, that sounds like Samurai Jack. Okay.
All right, new show. Koran Kazuki Nikki is the show. The concept is the head of a Japanese government bureau dedicated to studying the paranormal is forced to live with a cat girl as his quote-unquote wife and a variety of quote-unquote children in order to teach them the value of family and thus save the world. That is the concept.
Got it.
Are these plot points? Sarah Debunting. One of their children is a jellyfish who turns out to be the god of a water-covered planet fleeing an unwelcome marriage proposal.
Who amongst us, really? True.
Bobby. One of their children is a lion with superpowers that grant it the ability to speak with any other animal.
False.
True. Tara.
Yep.
One of their children is a bioweapon that looks suspiciously like a robot version of the xenomorph from the Alien movies.
True.
That is also true. Yes. All right. Next show is called FLCL. The concept. A 12-year-old boy's mundane suburban life is turned upside down after he's run down by a moped driven by a manic pink-haired woman carrying an electric guitar. Sarah Debunting, here's your plot point, true or false. The pink-haired girl that the boy spends time with holds an entire alternate dimension in her stomach. She sometimes eats him for fun.
Well, where do you keep your alternate dimension? I think that's false.
That is correct. That is a different anime called Hair and Goo. Or Goo.
Oh. The territory.
Hair like as in rabbit, though, not human, not on top of your head. Bobby, central to the plot is an interplanetary corporation called Medicinal Mechanica, which operates a series of factories that look like giant clothes irons and has imprisoned a near-omnipotent space pirate bird in the boy's hometown. A lot of information.
That's got to be true. That's true.
Tara.
Yep.
After being struck in the head, the boy's head becomes a portal from which giant robots periodically emerge. This seems to be partially a metaphor for puberty.
False.
It's true.
Man.
It's like you've never watched FLCL before.
It's almost exactly like that.
New show, Ranma One Half. A teenage boy is brought to a new city to follow through on an arranged marriage he's not aware of. But having fallen into a cursed spring, anytime he gets splashed with cold water, he becomes a girl. That is the concept. Plot point for Sarah D. Bundy. The principal of the high school is obsessed with Hawaii, wears a lei and sunglasses everywhere, and has a small palm tree growing out of the top of his head. He is obsessed with giving his students unflattering haircuts.
Oh, Gil's vengeance. I think that's true.
Yes, it is true, yes. Bobby, the hero is haunted by the 1,000-year-old ghost of an imperial courtier who drowned himself after losing a board game.
Relatable.
Yeah. Game night. True.
Yeah, that's true, correct. Tara, the hero's greatest rival holds a grudge against him for taking all the bread at the school cafeteria.
True.
The rival's vengeance... We're not even done yet, Tara.
I was with
Will
them already.
Will the second sentence change your mind? Let's find out. The rival's vengeance is continually stymied by his atrocious sense of direction.
I feel like I have to commit to true.
It is true, yes. All right, next show is a show we've talked about on Extra Hot Great before. It is called Polar Bear Cafe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In a world of anthropomorphic animals, a panda searching for a place to relax finds a nice cafe run by a polar bear. There are a lot of puns involved. Sarah D. Bunting. Panda gets a part-time job at the zoo where he acts like he's a non-personified panda for the amusement of humans.
I mean, it seems much too simplistic. I'm going to say true, though.
You are correct. Bobby. Panda greatly admires Sloth for his laziness and seeks him out as a mentor. He chickens out when he realizes that Sloth only goes to the bathroom once a week.
False.
That's true, my friend.
Oh.
And for Tara.
Yep.
Panda's friend Penguin's love interest, Penko, is half the size of a penguin because she is a little penguin and he is an emperor penguin. This is often played for laughs.
False.
You are correct, but that is a common trope in romance anime, but not in this show.
I see.
All right, our last show is coming up. We have two questions for each of you in our last little bit, so let's get these scores turned.
It's so close. I have 7 points. Sarah and Bobby are tied with 8 points.
Okay.
Apiece.
Let's go to our final show. It is JoJo's Bizarre Adventure.
Okay.
The concept. Generations of men in the Joestar family, all nicknamed JoJo, engage in epic, impeccably posed battles against myriad of exotic supernatural enemies. Sounds like these dudes just like to fight.
And pose.
Sarah D. Bunting. A hero punches a plate of spaghetti because he got a weird vibe from it. The punch reverts the spaghetti to its original ingredients.
I hope that this is true of something so that I can watch it. True.
Nice.
Bobby.
Amazing.
A hero hurls a misanthropic Boston Terrier at a blind man in the middle of the Sahara Desert.
I'm going to just, like the last one Sarah just said, this has to be true. True.
Correct. Tara. At one point, a character discovers that a pig has been living in his toilet.
Same. False.
True.
Oh.
That puts Tara out of the running.
I mean, I'm glad that's at least true. Sorry, T-Bone.
All right. So you both, Sarah and Bobby, are tied right now.
That's correct.
Last question coming at you. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yes.
One character is served a cup of steaming hot urine in a teacup. They drink it without suffering ill effects by transforming one of their teeth into a jellyfish.
I mean, sweet hack. I just... I mean, what would you do? I think that's false.
True!
No!
Now here is Bobby's chance to win the game.
Oh, God,
it comes
pressure.
Down to pee.
Here is your potential plot point from JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. There is an orangutan named Forever. He's psychic and obsessed with pornography.
That almost sounds too crazy not to be true. I'm going to say true.
Yay!
That is true. All right, let's close out with Tara's question. A vampire turns his hand into a squirrel. This squirrel kills and eats another squirrel, then burrows through a man's stomach.
True.
Yeah, sure. Everything about JoJo's Bizarre Adventures today was true.
Wow.
Feels like a show I might want to sample. That sounds fucking nuts.
Yeah.
Someone I follow on TikTok is into it and has been doing a lot of content about it this week.
Alone. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Excuse me. That is the end of regulation. Let's get those final scores, please, Tara.
All right. I finished with 8. Sarah had 9. Bobby is our victor. Putting the value guests on the board.
Yeah.
With 10.
Nicely done. All right. Before we make it official, let's use this tiebreaker for a future steel meal. Everybody gets a guess at this. You don't have to guess at the same time. We'll go in reverse score order. So Tara gets to go first, then Sarah, then Bobby guesses.
Okay.
All right. I'm going to ask you a question. You try to get closest to the pin number guess, not Price is Right rules, actually closest to the number. So I may have to pause to do some math.
Okay.
Per Wikipedia, as of August 2021, that's this month right now, guys, how many episodes have been aired in the mainstream Pokemon franchise in Japan?
600.
Sarah?
422.
Bobby?
630.
Your answer, Bobby taking all the points today, is 1,158.
That's incredible. Too many! Too many. Congratulations.
Valued guest.
Valued guest.
Congratulations, Bobby. Nicely done. Who
thank
knew?
You. If there's one thing I know nothing about, it's anime, so thank you.
You knew the least nothing about it. That's why you won. Well, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Break. We sat in judgment of the chair before going around the dial with stops at 9 Perfect Strangers, Messiness, I Think You Should Leave, and Unforgotten. We said da to Doug's extra credit request to Russian Roulette, a character from television. Sarah was thankful for the induction of her Cheers canon submission. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Bobby, playing for value guests, was the winner of this week's Game Time. Next up, Changing Lanes on Extra Extra Hot Great, and on the next EHG Prime, it's Shut Up At All. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David Teagle, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
chair sits at the head of the table.
Sarah D. Historic Murder Bunting.
Gobble, gobble.
And Bobby Crutt.
I promise to never be a gill.
Thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
What's it like to be you?
It's a mixed bag.